Thank you, everyone, for coming and welcome. This is PS113, iatrogenic nerve injury, and I'd like to welcome you all here and to the Congress. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be invited by the Congress to be helping on this panel. You guys are in for a great treat today. We have a number of experts from a variety of disciplines who are going to talk about very freely and openly how to manage the iatrogenic nerve injury. And I think that one of the things that we all hope you come out of this meeting with is the idea that recognizing the injury, admitting to the injury, and then doing what's necessary to move quickly and effectively on taking care of that injury is probably the best thing you could do, not just for your patient, but for yourselves. And so we'll just give a brief introduction to what we have in store for you today. From my perspective, we need to just think about understanding the true incidence of iatrogenic nerve injury. It's something that we all talk about. It can be very devastating to the patient, and it could also be devastating to you as a physician and as a surgeon. But the true incidence is really going to be hard to sort out, simply because we have the situation of sometimes not recognizing it, and of course the great amount of literature bias that would not necessarily bring to light these injuries. They do affect all aspects of medicine and surgery. Please note that although we're going to be talking about it from a perspective of surgery, understand that our colleagues on the medical side of things have this same issue occurring to them, probably at a much greater frequency than you will see in some of the data that we have here. And then, of course, unfortunately, we have to look at the idea that this injury is an injury that does seem to rear its head, ugly as it is, in the medical legal realm. And as a matter of fact, it seems to have a higher prevalence or a higher penetration rate within the medical legal field than it does in other aspects of medicine and surgery. We're not going to talk about the exam. We're not going to talk about how to identify the iatrogenic injury by exam. And we're certainly not going to spend an inordinate amount of time in performing the peripheral nerve exam. I think that's something that obviously has its own realm, and it takes its own amount of time to figure out, and we're not going to spend that time here. What we will talk about briefly are some of the key aspects. So the mechanism of injury obviously can be transection, but it can also be stretching. It can be compression when patients are placed in casts. Obviously, on the medical side of things, there can be a lot of injuries secondary to injection. Heat can be a point of injury to these nerves. Anticoagulants and the subsequent hematomas that develop from anticoagulation use causing a compression injury can be a key element in creating iatrogenic nerve injury. And we must not forget that even though we may not touch the patient, radiation doses can and have been reported as creating injury to the nerve, some of which can be even more difficult to handle than the transections. We'll briefly talk about here the types of injuries, and so I think everyone remembers these terms, if not from their current practice, certainly through their med school training, and that is the idea of neuropraxia, axonotmesis, and neuropmesis. And of course, as I said to you, when it comes to medical legal, that's all irrelevant. The actual types of injury become irrelevant to what happens in the medical legal world. But it's important to understand what we're going through as far as the injury itself to be able to predict, at least in part, for the patients and their families. That has been modified to the Sunderland criteria, which now talks about it in first, second, and third degrees, which pretty much match what we talked about, except that Sunderland had reported it over 5 degrees. And so what he did was he took the neurotmesis and actually substratified it according to whether it's a nerve fiber, that is, the endoneurium is injured, but the perineurium and epineurium is preserved. And that actually has some physiologic and some outcomes consequences, as you'll see, because that may or may not require surgery. Whereas for the fourth degree, as Sunderland describes it, the epineurium is preserved, but you therefore need to have surgery for that. And of course, the fifth degree is complete transection, and that's a complete neurotmesis, where, again, you need to resort to surgery. Is it a common occurrence? Well, there are many case reports. So if you talk about the fact that there are just a lot of case reports, then it may be relatively rare. If you look at some of the case series, though, these numbers do form a minority. And that is, for instance, an ephemeral nerve trial or review. Excuse me, sir? Sir? It's this screen right here. That's the problem. Oh, I apologize. Thank you. So when it comes to femoral nerve injuries, a series of 1,210 patients demonstrated 3 femoral nerve injuries, which is a 0.25% risk, and this was during abdominal hysterectomies with no dissections. Fortunately, all patients recovered within 9 months. Another large-ish series is 616 patients, with 3 patients having injury. If you look at the patients that have hip arthroplasties, partial hip arthroplasties, that rate goes down to 0.01%, whereas a lateral approach seems to be an order of magnitude higher. So it's a little bit hard to compare these studies because although they're all retrospective analyses, it is truly an apples to oranges comparison. There's just a lot of cases that are reported. There's no controls. No one talks about the techniques or the nuances to the techniques. And therefore, it becomes a real issue to try and get a true understanding of what that incidence is. It can have some rare manifestations. This is where we start talking a little bit about the neurological signs of these. So for instance, Frey syndrome, which is a gustatory swelling, is an effect of a postganglionic sympathetic fibers that are injured from the auriculotemporal branch during parotid gland surgery. I did mention medicine has some issues. Chemotherapy and radiation surgery has some issues with iatrogenic nerve injury, and I didn't want to just isolate us to surgery, and so I bring up a couple of phrenic nerve injury types that can occur either from cardiac surgery or even from chemotherapy, such as vincristine toxicity. Can we group things by the, quote, high-risk procedures? Well, we can, and you can see here, this isn't a slide that would be surprising to anyone. Osteotomies and arthrodeses are one of the key elements for high-risk procedures. When you're doing posterior cervical node biopsies, you are at risk, as well as carpal tunnel surgery, obviously. There have been a number of instances where varicose vein surgery has created some patients with pretty debilitating nerve injuries, and even things as straightforward as Baker cysts and inguinal hernia repairs can cause the occasional injury. This is a great report in the German literature that talks about major minor procedures and also the neurosurgical procedures and some of the non-surgical measures that have resulted in nerve injury with their respective numbers in parentheses. I don't want you to memorize this. I just want you to look at this as a sense of pretty much everything that we do is at risk. If we look at it more regionally and anatomically, of course, the posterior cervical triangle and the knee are probably one of the highest. I apologize for the typo on carpal tunnel. Obviously, whenever a nerve comes to a surface, such as near the fibular head or the elbow, you are at risk. And that can be a higher risk, not just from surgery, but from actual direct compression, whether it be a cast or an orthotic of any sort. The nerves, this is in descending order of frequency. The median nerve, interestingly, is one of the highest, and that's probably relative to the number of carpal tunnel releases that are done. An interesting thing that we need to think about as a specialty, that is the house of surgery, is does our attention and our direction towards minimally invasive or less invasive surgery increase the rate of exposure to nerve injury, either because of lack of experience, lack of proper visualization, the ability to move nerves out of the respective way when we do the surgery. It's something that we need to think about. Notice that the majority of these injuries were from an endoscopic approach. Thank you. The accessory nerve is the second highest and not by much, and you'll get to be treated by a wonderful story and discussion from Dr. Levin shortly about this. And then again, descending order sort of makes sense. Radial, common perineal, ulnar, which is usually a positioning problem in surgery. And then of course, we talked about femoral inguinal and the axillary, which occurs during open shoulder surgeries. Again, just trying to emphasize the issues by numbers. You can have traumatic nerve injury series that's been presented in 2001. 17.4% of those traumatic injuries were actually iatrogenic, 94% of which were actually during surgery. It is a big deal. It's something that we need to pay attention to, even though in the overall course of a lifetime or your career, it may not occur as often as you think. When we look at sciatic nerve, you think about the size of that nerve and its location, and still, you can have a quarter of those patients in that series undergoing some form of a complication to the sciatic nerve, secondary simply to a medical intervention of some sort. And even in a small series of 73, we're getting close to almost half just from intragluteal injections. So we have the injuries, what are the outcomes? Well, 46% have a slight improvement, so that's pretty good, almost half. But the problem is, it's almost half. Over a quarter have no improvement or worsening over the course of time. And again, this is something that a patient went in for something else, and now they've got a potentially debilitating problem that they have to deal with, even though their original cause of injury was corrected and rectified by your surgery. Another thing that's important is time. A lot of these patients that had the worsening or that had no change was because they were referred after 6 months post-injury. And I think that becomes an important take-home message as well. An interesting thing is that some of the nerves, the cranial nerve 11, radial and tibial, do seem to have good prognosis, and always be aware of positioning your patients. When it comes to repairing, there's a simple, straightforward process. You're going to hear the cutting edge, no pun intended, on the treatment of iatrogenic nerve injuries today. And so I'm going to leave it to the experts to talk to you about that. But please note that one of the key elements is no nerve shall be under tension during repair. How big of a problem is this medical legally? And I'm sorry that we have to bring this up, but we have to face the realities in medicine today. Herb's palsy on delivery got $6 million. Nerve damage to the bladder because of nursing negligence got $2.3 million. Direct nerve damage from an IV placement, almost $1 million. There is a website. I didn't take more than maybe a minute to look this up, and I got that website that you have there. You can put a value to your own nerve damage and then contact this law firm, and you know plus minus how much you're going to get because you had nerve damage. And again, all I typed in was nerve injury lawyer. That's what you get. That's the environment. If you look at this in a more scientific way, as opposed to coursing through the internet, you can look at this paper, which I thought was a very good paper, looking at 2,500 medical legal cases, and you can see that 217 of those 2,500 cases are iatrogenic nerve injury cases. It's a big deal in the medical legal world. 42 were lower, 42 were upper extremities. 26 were spinal accessory. 60% of these were all secondary to surgery, and under a quarter were secondary to injection or venipuncture. And so, if we try to get a sense of has the incidence of iatrogenic nerve injury changed, it's hard to do. A lot of the papers that you saw are from the early 2000s. That's not because I sort of garnered my search for the earlier part. It's just that a lot of this is on case series basis. They're very specific to nerves or very specific to the type of surgery. And once it's mentioned and discussed, it takes a lot of work to go back and try to look at it again a decade later. What has happened during that decade? We've had an explosion of minimally invasive surgery, not just in the realm and in the house of surgery in general, but even in things like neurosurgery. And the question that we have to ask is, are the goalposts moving? Is iatrogenic nerve injury changing by definition based on the techniques of surgery? So for instance, acoustic neuroma surgery, if you had an acoustic neuroma, you were almost guaranteed hearing loss. As a matter of fact, not almost. Up until 20 years ago, 15 years ago, you were told you will not have hearing on that side of the operation, period, end. Your facial nerve might get injured, and that became sort of the moving point. Today, if you have a tumor less than a couple of centimeters and you have 50% speech discrimination and 50% on your audiogram, on decibel recognition, there is about a 50% chance of hearing preservation. So now what happens if you're the patient, you go in to get surgery, they talk about hearing preservation, they say, well, you know, there's a 50% chance that we won't be able to preserve your hearing. but now your hearing is not preserved. Is that iatrogenic injury to the nerve? Will a lawyer pick up that case is probably the bigger question. And you never know, especially if you have a 1.5 centimeter tumor that you're going to resect. And so be aware that the goalposts are changing. And so I think one of the key elements to that is discussion. You're never going to reduce the risk of iatrogenic nerve injury to zero. That just won't happen. None of us are that good. However, the key thing that we need to be sure about, as I paraphrase Birch, Boney, and Parry, is don't let it go unrecognized, and by goodness, don't let it go unmanaged. That's the most important take home. If you want to talk about how to repair these, you're going to hear the experts talking about it. This is just a basic algorithm that we don't need to discuss, because I think the more important things is to hear where we are at the tip of the spear on managing iatrogenic nerve injury. But just remember that it's a rare occurrence, but it's significant. It's debilitating. It's not all that often discussed in the literature, as I just mentioned to you. And so just the message to you folks is to be aware and be wary. Always be prepared. Come up with the plan B. And then, of course, never deny it or ignore it. And I think for that, we're going to move on to the speakers that are going to talk today about various aspects of just how to talk to patients, how to take care of these patients in general. And then we'll try to do sort of a regionally localized way of treating and managing these patients, along with some of the most up-to-date research and newer techniques.